Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jason Middleton, registration number 25314, and I'm appearing on behalf of Carol Ounsbury in this matter. Your Honors, I believe that all of the issues in this case are actually significant and warrant reversal, but for purposes of today, I plan to focus my argument on issue one of the opening brief. The two main figures in this trial were Jared Enander and Carol Ounsbury, the surviving children of one of the murder victims, Harold Enander. Both of them testified at trial. The evidence demonstrated that each had accused the other of these murders and that both had been considered suspects by the police. The evaluation of their testimony and credibility was a critical task for the jury in this case. However, certain rulings of the trial court interfered with Ms. Lounsbury's ability to effectively confront and cross-examine Jared Enander, while at the same time undermining her ability to adequately present her defense and to testify on her own behalf. This resulted in a one-sided, misleading portrayal of the evidence and of these two witnesses to Ms. Lounsbury's detriment and in violation of her constitutional rights. When Jared Enander spoke with the police, he spoke with them numerous times, and he attributed a motive to his sister for committing these murders. Of the primary motive he attributed to her was an allegation that she had been sexually assaulted by their father. He gave very specific information in this respect, saying that Ms. Lounsbury's therapist, Barbara Norris, had told the family that Ms. Lounsbury had made these allegations and had come to the family and essentially violated confidence and told them that these allegations existed. The defense spoke with Ms. Norris in preparation for the trial, and she said that was untrue. She said that there were no such allegations made by Ms. Lounsbury and that she never told the family of any such allegations. The defense wanted to present this in order to challenge Jared Enander's credibility in terms of the statements he was giving to the police, just directly as a matter of direct contradiction, as well as demonstrating his attempt to deflect attention from himself by creating this false motive for Ms. Lounsbury. The trial court precluded this evidence. The trial court held that it was bad character evidence and held that it was, if I can find the language, not offered in an attempt to justify, mitigate, or excuse the offense. Essentially, the trial court seemed to miss the confrontation and cross-examination claim that was being made by the defense. This was not an effort to argue heat of passion or some such defense. It was to challenge Jared Enander's credibility. At trial, Jared was able to testify that the supposed motive was quote-unquote about money, I guess, and the defense was unable to challenge the statement due to the trial court's rulings. So Mr. Enander, Jared Enander, was essentially allowed to testify. I wouldn't say it's false because he did mention money to the police, but it was certainly a half-truth at best, and the defense was unable to attack him in that respect.
Counsel, yes. Given that these allegations of sexual abuse were challenged or unsubstantiated, wasn't there a danger that they could have confused the issues at trial such that, you know, under doing a 403 analysis, the trial court properly excluded that information? And, you know, obviously it was also remote in time. So if you could address
sure
why that wouldn't have confused the jury about the issues that were before the court for trial.
Right. Well, first of all, Ms. Lounsbury's position was that there was no sexual assault. The prosecution raised, and they just sort of threw this out in the context of the 404B hearing, said that Geraldine Pett, who was the first wife of Harold Enander, said that these had been reported at some point. Whether or not the prosecution was going to attempt to establish that there were allegations, I think would have been up to the prosecution. It wouldn't have necessarily been implicated by Ms. Lounsbury's attempt to impeach Jared Enander with the therapist's testimony. Because that's a very specific thing. He said the therapist said certain things and did certain things, and she would say no.
But isn't there a risk in this case that, you know, suddenly this doesn't become about the murder, it becomes about the alleged sexual assault and whether it happened or didn't, and so you end up having a trial within a trial, and nobody's on trial for sexual assault?
Well, I understand, and I think there is an aspect of that, but I also think that given the critical importance of Jared Enander in this case, and the fact that he was attempting to deflect attention from himself, it appears, that this was of critical importance to Ms. Lounsbury's ability to cross-examine and confront him, which would outweigh any minimal risk of confusion of the issues, which I don't really think exists too much. I mean, you know, if the prosecution, for one, I'm not sure they would have been coming in trying to establish that one of their victims in the case did commit sexual assault. In fact, they were vehemently opposed to that in the hearing, so I'm not sure it would have happened. And the defense, as I said, wanted to make clear that they were saying it never happened. So there is some risk there, but I think Ms. Lounsbury's constitutional rights far outweigh those risks.
Counsel, were you counsel at the trial court?
I was not.
Okay. In the record, it shows that Ms. Lounsbury's trial counsel, not the prosecutor, told the court that before the murders, Jason had been telling her about the alleged sexual abuse, and she had been, quote, inquiring all over the place, end quote, about the details. So that came from defense counsel, okay? And I assume he got it from his client. So in other words, before the murders, independently of anything that Jason told the police, she had been alerted to these allegations and was inquiring about them. So again, how does that show that he's making up a motive? That only works, doesn't it, if she's never heard about this before?
My understanding of that is that, and it's a little confused because a lot of the 404B evidence is referring to discovery, and it's some of the sources are not particularly clear. My understanding of that was that that was from Jared as part of his discussions about the sexual assault allegations, was that he was saying that he told her at this meeting that I forget, they were having lunch somewhere, Red Robin or something like that, and that they had this discussion and that she was going around asking about it. So that was my understanding of that particular evidence.
So just so I understand what you're saying, your understanding of the record is that Brother was the source, or Jared was the source of the notion that defendant had been inquiring all over the place into these allegations.
That's my understanding, yes. But I think even if that's not true, I mean, he is the one who, by all the evidence, told her about this supposed sexual abuse. And then she followed up on it. I think, again, it just goes to whether or not there is any validity to this. This family had a number of issues that I think it was a very tumultuous family situation. There were allegations, there were a variety of allegations of different types of sexual misconduct. So it's a little unclear as to how it all fits in, but he's attributing, again, it gets back to he's saying Barbara Norris, the therapist, told him something very specific, did certain very specific things, and that was his basis for the motive. She says that never happened. The defense should have been allowed to present that evidence to contradict his statements to the police and impeach him. The next area is sort of the history of conflict between Jared Enander and his father, Harold Enander. The defense brought up a number of different things. The two that we focused on in the opening brief were mainly the situation where there was this allegation of some type of sexual misconduct between Jared Enander and his stepmother, who was Harold Enander's second wife, and Jared going to his father about this misconduct, and his father essentially not believing him and taking the side of the wife at the time, which created a conflict between Jared Enander and his father, Harold Enander. Likewise, there was also an attempt by Harold Enander to have Jared Enander committed to a mental institution as a juvenile. And again, there was a great deal of resentment on Jared's part related to those two situations.
Why are those two situations not cumulative of the other testimony that did come in concerning, you know, Jared acknowledging that his father did not have his back? I mean, he effectively conceded that, so wouldn't that be cumulative?
He conceded it, and there was testimony from other witnesses too that where they thought that that was related to this business dispute, which did come in at trial. There was this business dispute. He testified that basically they patched up the business dispute and everything was pretty much okay with them from that point on. And they did talk about, quote unquote, some childhood issues. Mrs. Lounsbury's defense was that he had a long-standing animosity and resentment and poor relationship with the father. And so it was not cumulative because the extent of their animosity or his animosity towards the father was never fully explored.
Well, counsel, those incidents occurred more than 20 years before the trial, I think as long as 25 years before the trial.
Correct.
I mean, again, it seems to me the trial judge is looking at a situation where he's faced with litigating whether these things happened 25 years earlier. Why isn't that a discretionary call in terms of remoteness and relevance?
Well, a couple reasons. One is there wouldn't be litigation about whether it occurred because Jared said it occurred. This information comes from him saying that these were resentments on his part, which is also significant because this is 25 years later and he's telling the police about this. These things are still raw with him. And it's a continuous course of conduct, is the argument, is that they had a poor relationship all along. There was this animosity all along. There wasn't just some little business dispute, but it was a life of animosity. And Ms. Lounsbury was not allowed to present that evidence. And Mr. Jared Yenander was allowed to minimize it when he just talked about some childhood issues, which then the defense could not explore. And it gets to the third part of this component, which is Ms. Lounsbury's testimony. When she testified, the prosecution inquired as to why she pointed the finger at her brother. And she provided motive. Part of the motive was the business dispute. Part of it was the long-standing animosity, and in her words, hatred of her father. The prosecution elicited this on cross-examination and basically pointed out that she had no evidence to support this long-standing hatred. Basically sort of mocked her for saying that Jared hated the brother because there's no evidence to support it. When in fact there was, but she was prevented from presenting it and testifying to it by the trial court's ruling. So she was prevented from supporting her own testimony that was elicited by the prosecutor. And so it directly impacted her ability to testify regarding the truth, her state of mind, her version of events. So there was that impact as well. And again, I think that all of these sort of go together where you have an effect of a very one-sided misleading portrayal where Jared Yenander is allowed to essentially testify without being subject to cross-examination on some critical issues. And then when Ms. Lounsbury testifies and is cross-examined about critical issues, she's not allowed to explain because the evidence was precluded.
Counsel, could you flesh that out for me when you say she was not allowed? When the prosecutor asked her if she had any evidence to support her theory, she said no, or she said, I do have some, but I can't tell you, or she stopped herself? How did that
well,
work?
Well, one of the questions was, Jared had disagreements. She said many, but she couldn't go any further than that. By the trial court's rulings, I mean, the trial court had made clear that no one could get into these things. So I assume trial counsel had instructed her as to what she could and couldn't say. So that's one example of it was very minimal in terms of what she could say, and it really undercut her defense and her ability to defend it. So it looked like she was the one providing a false motive, when in fact we would say that Jared was the one providing a false motive.
Counsel, I want to be clear on this as well procedurally. So you're not saying that there was a question asked of Ms. Lounsbury that she was prohibited from answering. You're just saying she gave an answer and she thought that her answer had to be limited. But you're not saying that, say, on recross or redirect or anything like that defense counsel asked her to explain and she was prohibited from doing that.
Defense counsel did not ask her to explain. I I mean, the trial court made its rulings clear. No one made an opening the door argument, I guess, if that's what the court is inquiring. But yes, I mean, she was on cross-examination. Questions were asked of her. She answered, in the context of the court's rulings, her answers were very limited.
But is there anything on the record which shows that her answers were affected by the court's ruling? Did she say that? Did defense counsel say that? How do we know that her answers were so influenced by this earlier trial court ruling?
Well, I guess the presumption would be that she abided by the court's rulings. I mean, there was this ruling in place.
But there was no offer of proof about what she would have said if these rulings were not in place.
At the time, no, there was not. There was no follow-up offer of proof, and there was no argument that the door had been opened and been attempting to get in at that point.
Thank you.
So I see my time is up or almost up. So I'd reserve the remainder for
it. It's up.
Oh, it's up. Then I won't.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Erin Grundy, registration number 41271, and I represent the people. In this case, the trial court properly acted as the gatekeeper by excluding irrelevant information that would have distracted and confused the jury from the primary focus of this case. Because this ruling was proper, there is no violation of the Confrontation Clause, nor does it chill the defendant's right to testify. Instead, the trial court acted exactly as the relevancy rules require that it do. The Constitution requires only that an accused be able to present all relevant evidence that is admissible, and trial courts may exclude alternate suspect evidence that will encourage the jury to engage in undue speculation. That's exactly what we're looking at here. If we look to our Supreme Court's decision in Salazar, we see that this is particularly true of unsubstantiated allegations of sexual assault. And moving specifically to the allegations that the victim had assaulted the defendant when she was a child, maybe 20 years prior to the incidents, this would have created a mini trial within the trial to establish the veracity of these allegations, especially because the defendant's theory of admission hinges on the allegation being false. So it rests on the logical inference that the sexual assault did not occur, that Jared knew that, and that he knew that when he told police that this was a possible motive for his sister.
Counsel, how did you respond to your opponent's contention that we basically had a one-sided presentation of the evidence where, you know, the brother got to point the finger at the sister, but the sister was not able to defend herself? How do you respond to that?
I think that the record refutes that claim. If we look specifically, I mean, even in the defendant's opening brief, they note that Jared's motive to testify was to avert attention away from himself. And essentially, this evidence came in. The jury was well aware that Jared had provided the surveillance footage prior to any police request. The jury was aware that Jared Anander had brought a shoe to one of the court hearings and provided that to the prosecution. The court was aware that Mr. Anander had substantial business disputes with his father and that he had directed attention to his sister, that he'd provided police with the information about her Glock 26, and all of this information came in. The defense theory at trial was that Mr. Anander had framed his sister for the murders and that he'd actually committed the murders. We see even in the defense opening statement that they started with Mr. and Mrs. Anander were not killed by a daughter, they were killed by a son. So this entire theory is fleshed out for the jury. They're well aware of it, and they're well aware of the credibility determinations that they're required to make. Substantial cross-examination of Jared Anander is allowed into the business disputes. We also see a number of other witnesses testifying about the business disputes. So what the trial court did here was to permit the otherwise appropriate cross-examination into prototypical forms of bias, exactly what Kinney and Van Arsdell tell us is the appropriate scope of cross-examination. It allowed an inquiry into the subjects, but excluded inquiry into areas that would have essentially created a sideshow and a mini trial, making sexual assault a critical issue in this case. It simply wasn't. We weren't looking at lesser includeds, and the trial court properly excluded this evidence. Now, if you look at the January 27th, 2010 and January 29th, 2010 motions hearings, you can see a little more the basis for the trial court's ruling. And part of it is that this evidence was presented to the trial court as alternate suspect evidence designed to tie Mr. Anander to the crimes. Defense counsel at trial actually argued that the absence of underwear from the crime scene may have gone to the identity of the alternate suspect, because the trial court's written order had also made clear that he was excluding this evidence because it goes to the motive and opportunity of an alternate suspect and isn't properly allowed under those rules. Now, on appeal, the defendant focuses on the confrontation and bias issues that are incorporated in this testimony. And while those are present, those were fleshed out, and they were appropriately limited by the rules of relevancy. And this sex assault poses a very substantial danger. And as the trial court said, it's only tenuously relevant, especially because it hinges on these logical inferences as to whether it may or may not have occurred. And the same is true with the long history of conflict with Mr. Anander and his father. Now, the jury was aware that there was a history of conflict. They were aware of this business dispute. They were aware of the sheer amount of money involved in that business dispute, and that Mr. Anander had told Skip Higgins, who was a neighbor of his parents, that he never wanted to see his father again. So the jury knew a substantial portion of this. They weren't informed of the possible panty incident with his ex-stepmother and what that may have led to, because that wasn't relevant to the issues before the court. That's maybe 25 years prior, and it doesn't go to a prototypical form of bias. It instead goes to the motive and opportunity of an alternate suspect, and was therefore properly excluded by the court. Now, in terms of the business dispute, even if Mr. Anander did attempt to essentially mitigate or diminish the importance of this, we have a number of other witnesses testifying about this business dispute. We have the, I'm not sure if it's the president or CEO, but the manager of the Aquahot Corporation coming in and explaining exactly how the business dispute came down, the amount of money, how displeased he was. We even have the defendant's husband testifying that the employees of Aquahot perceived Mr. Anander to be a bit of a parasite on the company. And we know about this history. We also have Jared's specific testimony that he thought about killing his father and ex-stepmother because of family issues. We know that he believed his father had darker secrets and that he was not always a wonderful father. We know that he believed his father let him down and that he told Skip Higgins he never wanted to see his father again. So this evidence comes in. The jury's not left with a substantially different impression than they would have been had evidence of the relevant sexual assaults 25 years ago that had never been substantiated come in. The jury was not left with a different impression than they would have been had evidence of an incident with explosives and possible mental health ward come in. All of that evidence was tenuous, far removed, and doesn't fit into what we traditionally see as a prototypical form of bias or otherwise appropriate cross-examination. And as the U.S. Supreme Court explained in Holmes versus South Carolina, the relevancy rules particularly apply when a defendant is trying to show that someone else committed the crime. And a trial court may still promote the rule that a trial focus on the central issue rather than be distracted by sideshows taking over the presentation of evidence that is properly before the court.
Counsel, I want to make sure I understand your position on the alternate suspect theory, which I understand was excluded by the court. Given that the theory was excluded by the court, did that preclude the defendant, though, from indicating that somebody else had a motive?
No, Your Honor, it didn't. And I would argue that that evidence certainly came in, especially if you look at the defense opening and closing statement, as well as their cross-examination of Jared Anander. We see that this was fleshed out. But what the trial court did was to focus it on the issues that were actually relevant and that could be substantiated. Well, essentially excluding extrinsic evidence of an alternate suspect's motive and opportunity when there was no sort of identity established to directly tie Jared Anander to the crime.
But why should a court assume that a jury will give more weight to this incident relating to the business than these childhood incidents? Couldn't the jury reasonably conclude that these childhood incidents provided more of a motive than the recent business dispute?
Your Honor, the jury could have, and that's exactly the danger that this evidence presents, that when we look at the motive and opportunity of an alternate suspect without anything actually tying that person to the crime, that evidence is properly excluded by the trial court. Now here, the trial court permitted the evidence to come in of the business dispute because it essentially provided the situation for what had occurred. But it excluded this evidence about panties in the laundry, about explosive 25 years ago, because that was not relevant. And effectively, the motive information was not properly admissible alternate suspect evidence. Yet they allowed the portions that truly went to bias, that truly went to a motive to testify, or a motive that was relevant to this case. Yet it excluded the irrelevant sexual assault information that would have created a mini trial within the trial. And the evidence that was excluded would have been cumulative to the ultimate issues before the court. Here, the entire defense was about Jared's motive to commit the crime. And the entire defense was about his incentive to frame his sister. So the motive for testifying under Davis was satisfied. And the defendant had the crucial opportunity to present her defense. So if this court has no further questions, the people respectfully request that this court affirm the defendant's convictions.
Thank you, counsel. Case will stand submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.